KPCW News. Time is now 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. Here with a report, we've got Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back, heading into an all-important busy weekend. Let's talk about your Friday forecast first. Lots of sunshine expected today, just a few clouds streaming through from time to time, but we'll call it mostly sunny skies. Highs will be in the upper 60s for your Friday afternoon in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your upcoming weekend, how about that sunshine on your Saturday? Highs climb into the upper 60s once again in Park City. We'll be nearing 70 degrees in some places. Otherwise, in the Heber Valley, you are going to climb into the mid-70s as we go towards your Saturday. It gets even warmer as we move into your Sunday, Mother's Day itself. Lots of sunshine. We're looking at temperatures climbing into the mid-70s for us in Park City. So if you're taking mom out for brunch or an afternoon exploration trip around the Park City area, we're looking at those temperatures very nice in the mid-70s. We'll see those temperatures climbing to around 80 degrees in the Heber Valley. So some beautiful weather. May even want to take a walk by a lake out there as we look at those temperatures staying on the very warm side. As we head into next week, the warm-up continues at least early next week. We're going to be talking about the core of some potentially record-breaking heat building over northern Utah. So we're looking at high temperatures for your Monday and Tuesday in Park City. Get this, climbing into the low to mid-80s. Yes, in Park City, we'll be seeing those high temperatures around 90 degrees for your Monday and Tuesday in the Heber Valley with that sunshine. So again, get ready for some big time summer heat settling in early next week. Now, once we get past Tuesday, that high pressure ridge and that heat dome will begin to shift to our east. That should take the core of the heat off to our east, but it's still going to stay very warm. Your Wednesday will feature partly cloudy skies with highs around 80 in Park City. We'll see those highs dropping back into the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. By next Thursday, lots of sunshine, mid-70s in Park City with highs in the low 80s in the Heber Valley. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, we're going to hear an interview that Connor Thomas did with Gene Shawcroft about drought and the Colorado River. Then Diego Zagara, Park City Councilperson, will stop by with a debrief from last night's Park City Council meeting. We'll finish our hour by chatting about the new Box Elder Data Center project. Stay tuned. A federal judge has just tossed a lawsuit that alleged that Camas leaders and others conspired to block the incorporation of a new Eastern Summit County town. KPCW's Connor Thomas has the latest on the fight over West Hills.
Backers of West Hills sued its opponents in August of last year, 3 months before the incorporation proposal was to be decided by voters. The claim by a pro-West Hills group called The Preserve was that Camas City leaders and the Camas Valley Preservation Association had launched a coordinated effort to sour locals on the plan. They wanted such efforts stopped and for Camas City to rescind an ordinance opposing West Hills before any ballots were cast. The election was called off, at least for 1 year. And on Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Ted Stewart declined to sanction Camas, KVPA, or any of the named defendants. The judge found the various emails and communications the lawsuit relied on didn't amount to fraud or a pattern of illegal activity. The Preserve was formerly Cascade Capital Group and owns 266 acres between the Camas Gun Club and Toohey, south of State Route 248. It had accused Camas Mayor Matt McCormick and nearby residents Jeremy Bristol, Lindy Sternlight, and Craig Savage of conspiracy. Savage, who lives in Toohey, was happy to hear about the dismissal.
To be honest with you, it was so silly, I totally forgot about it. I knew this would be the result, and I'm thankful that the district court or the federal court saw it that way.
The Preserve had sued under the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, the 1970 federal law aimed at eliminating the mafia and organized crime. The Preserve is owned in part by Sam Castor, an attorney with Las Vegas-based Lex Technica, which drafted the lawsuit. Castor told KPCW in a statement that the Preserve, quote, plans to continue litigating. McCormick didn't immediately respond to a request for comment.
They can't go after, you know, public officials and professional people without foundation.
Multiple West Hills supporters are attorneys at firms that have now mobilized against local governments. They believe public officials in Summit County have not been sufficiently neutral on incorporation. A new state lawsuit was filed April 29th by the Salt Lake City firm Kimball Anderson, where the incorporation's sponsor, Derek Anderson, is a partner. His colleagues Paul Anderson and William Kimball are fighting for the release of Summit County records that they believe will demonstrate, quote, coordinated opposition, unquote, to West Hills. Those requests have been repeatedly rejected and labeled overly broad. The county has not responded in court. The November 2025 vote on West Hills never happened because 10 landowners opposing the town successfully sued to block it. That lawsuit is still pending, so there's a chance the town goes back on the ballot this year. The parties are awaiting a final decision from the Utah Supreme Court, which heard oral arguments in February. An attorney retained by the Camas Valley Preservation Association and its current and former members, Michael Judd, is a shareholder at Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, which is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Dry conditions are prompting calls for conservation across Utah and here at home in the Wasatch Back. And all the while, the seven states that draw water from the Colorado River are renegotiating how that river, which is overallocated, is shared. KPCW's Connor Thomas discussed these issues with Gene Shawcroft late last month. Shawcroft represents Utah on all Colorado River issues and runs the most significant water wholesaler in the state.
We are here with Gene Shawcroft. He's the general manager of the Central Utah Water Conservancy District, also the lead Colorado River commissioner for the Upper Basin, or representing Utah in the Upper Basin. Gene, thank you so much for making the time.
Happy to be with you, Connor. Always nice to talk about water.
Always. So maybe people, just to step back, if folks don't know what the Central Utah Water Conservancy District is, it covers Salt Lake, Utah, Juab, San Pete, and then Summit and Wasatch counties, the last two where most of our listeners are. Could you talk a little bit about what you do? Is it too simple to say that you basically just manage the Central Utah Project?
Well, Connor, that's a short way to describe manage the Central Utah Project. The project, as you mentioned, covers a number of counties. It brings a major portion of Utah's allocation of the Colorado River, which of course is on the eastern side of the state. We bring that water into the Great Basin, the Wasatch Front, and there is not a pipeline from the Green River to the Wasatch Front. What we do is we collect water on the south slope of the Uintas, starting north of Duchesne, and that water comes through a pipeline tunnel all by gravity from those streams, starting at Rock Creek, which is where Upper Stillwater Dam is. There's a pipeline through the mountain that brings water into Strawberry Reservoir. Many folks have driven to Duchesne and have seen a lot of people fishing at what we call the ladders, and that's where the water comes from the collection system into Strawberry Reservoir. And then on the west side of Strawberry Reservoir, there is a tunnel that takes water from Strawberry Reservoir, brings it down Diamond Fork Canyon, down Spanish Fork Canyon, and then can deliver water all the way into Salt Lake by gravity from that system. So that's just a quick nutshell of what the Central Utah Project is. And then the Central Utah Water Conservancy District is responsible to maintain, to manage that system and the water that's available from that system.
Yeah, because I'm not sure how many of us in Heber know that they're kind of part of the Colorado River watershed and because of those chutes and ladders that you just described. And maybe you just mentioned, but where does the tunnel let out into the Provo? Is it above Jordanelle, Deer Creek? Where along the flow is it?
Yeah, the tunnel that brings water from the Provo River, from the Duchesne River, is actually operated by the Provo River Water Users Association. And that tunnel picks up water from the Duchesne River, which is in the Colorado River Basin, and brings it through a tunnel into the upper Provo. And then that water comes into Deer Creek, Jordanelle Reservoir in Deer Creek. What we do is we manage a series of what we call exchanges. So even though the water in Jordanelle is water from the Provo River, those water rights on the Provo River were much, much senior or used first before we could store water in Jordanelle. And so part of what we do is we bring water from the Colorado River Basin into the Wasatch Front to make deliveries to water users that historically got their water from the Provo River. And then that equivalent amount of water we can store in Jordanelle and make deliveries from Jordanelle then along the Wasatch Front. So it's fairly complicated, but then again, it's fairly simple in that we take water from one place, put it in another place, and then exchange that water into other locations where we can use it more efficiently and effectively.
Definitely. And we're recording this on April 24th. And this week, the Water Conservancy District released a resolution about our current ongoing drought and kind of the plan for this summer. Could you kind of just summarize how bad the drought is right now?
Sure. We are in a situation where the amount of water that's in the snow has never been lower than it is this year. And not just a little bit, but by quite a bit. So as far as the snowpack this year, it is lower than we've ever seen it. And the water that melts from the snow typically peaks in our river systems in late May. Memorial weekend is generally about the time we see the highest water, for example, on the Provo and the Duchesne and those rivers. This year, there is no peak. The water, the major part of the water in the snowpack is gone. There's still a little bit of snow up real high, but it doesn't cover a broad area. So there's not a lot of water that will come out of that. And so we're in a situation that we have never seen before. It's unprecedented as to how low the snowpack was this year. And it's dire as far as runoff, as far as snowpack is concerned. And so that's part of the reason our board elected to send out this resolution. And really the resolution focuses on three things. Number one, it focuses on how dire the situation is. Haven't seen anything like this in the past. The second thing that we have focused on is the fact that we need to encourage and be extremely diligent about conservation this year. And that conservation ethic isn't something that just should happen on a dry year. We over time, with our increasing population, we need to be able to use much, much less water per household than we ever have. And we need to continue to work with our homeowners. We have programs to remove lawn. That's where most of our water goes in the municipal sector, is on our lawns, outside water use. We need to be in a situation where we are reducing that, and that's happening. Express gratitude to the population in general. Our water use per person is declining, but we need to do much better. And then the third thing that we put in there and that we have in the resolution is the fact that but for these large facilities that have been in the ground now for a number of years, Strawberry Reservoir, for example, the collection system into Strawberry, but for those things, we'd be in situations where we'd have shortages. But because of that infrastructure, because of the foresight of our forefathers, we have a sufficient supply of water this year, and we'll manage it very, very carefully and closely and hope that next year is better than this year. Don't know how it can be worse, but we have adequate supplies because of infrastructure that's been in the ground for years. We have the ability to make deliveries this year to our communities, what they anticipate getting on a normal year. So project is doing what it was intended to do. We're dire as far as the availability of water this year, and we need to conserve and continue to conserve, but grateful for those who have put us in a position where a year like this, we're still able to take delivery of our water.
You are a wholesaler, so folks probably don't see the Central Utah Water Conservancy District on their bill, you sell it to the company that is on the bill. But you're that glue between probably the most significant river, the Green in the Colorado, to the most significant population center of the state. So maybe we can move into some of the state of Colorado river negotiations, which I know is a long-term conversation because it's talking about managing that river and its water over the course of years and decades. But the fact that these negotiations this year are unfolding after such a warm winter and serious drought, what is that making those conversations like?
That's a great question, Connor. And you are right. We are in the middle of negotiations on how we operate the river. Let me just give you a bit of background. There is a compact that was signed by the seven states in 1922, 100 years ago, that helped manage the division of the water among those seven states. A lot of history, a lot of agreements, but in 2007, the seven states agreed that the river could be operated in a certain fashion for the next 20 years, which of course that policy or those guidelines expire on September 30th of this year, 2026. That's the 20-year period. So what we are trying to do is not renegotiate the compact. That's not what we're up to. What we're trying to do is understand how we distribute a lower amount of water than was anticipated being in the river. And that's extremely difficult because people are used to using that water. And it's a challenge now to try to understand how we can all reduce our use somewhat in order to try to stabilize the system. Those guidelines that were passed in 2007 were negotiated when Lakes Powell and Mead were relatively full, and there was no concept of how bad the hydrology, water available, when I say hydrology, water available in the system, how low that would be over the next 20 years. So as a result of not understanding exactly how much water we would have and the guidelines that were in place, which allowed the lower basin to continue to use the same amount of water that they were entitled to, that is what has caused Lakes Powell and Lake Mead to be so extremely low.
Real quick, which states are in the lower and upper basins for people that are completely unfamiliar?
Okay, thank you, Connor. The upper division states are Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming. So we call those the upper division states. The lower division states are Nevada, California, and Arizona. So with the challenge of the reservoirs being relatively low and this horribly dire hydrology, it certainly complicates our discussions and complicates a resolution. That's part of the reason we have not come to resolution. And I think most folks are aware that we have not achieved what we had hoped to do, and that was to come up with a seven-state consensus alternative. And so we're still talking, we're still trying to figure that out. But if we don't have something figured out very soon, then Reclamation will move forward with the alternatives they have in their draft environmental impact statement.
And you're referring to the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. Those are the national level water guys. My understanding was they will move forward because of the missed deadline this year. Is that not quite happening yet?
They are moving forward. There will be additional water released from Flaming Gorge Reservoir to Lake Powell to try to help keep elevation in Powell a little bit higher. The other thing that's happening is the amount of water that will be released from Lake Powell will be reduced. So the idea is bring more water in and let less water out. And that's then how Reclamation intends to keep the elevation in Lake Powell at an elevation that they can generate power and make deliveries to the lower basin states.
And of course, without that level of elevation, then the ability for water to make it through the dam, Glen Canyon Dam at all, I believe, is sort of in jeopardy.
It is. There are valves low in the dam that can let water out, but they weren't designed to operate on a day-to-day basis. The water going through the penstocks and the power generators is what is intended to operate day in and day out. And if they can keep the elevation high enough, then they can continue to generate power and make the releases. You're right.
That's one of the federal government's sort of emergency measures. You know, how much room do we have in Flaming Gorge to supplement Lake Powell, and for how long?
A lot of that depends on what comes into Flaming Gorge next year. But right now, the flows into Flaming Gorge are extremely low. Flaming Gorge holds roughly about 3.5 million acre feet. And this year, Reclamation intends to release 1 million acre feet from Flaming Gorge to Lake Powell. They can do that this year. If we're in such a situation again next year, it will be questionable whether they can actually do that again with that volume of water, another million acre feet. We're hoping we don't have to come to that point, but it's this million acre feet, though it has tremendous impact, wouldn't have as near as much impact as if there has to be an additional big release from Flaming Gorge next year.
Anything else that you want to mention?
Connor, thank you for your willingness to help people understand the dire situation we're in. Grateful that you're willing to learn a little bit about the complexities of this and share it with your listeners. My plea would be to everyone recognize the situation we're in. Every drop of water we conserve this year is available for future use. And this is a very, very finite resource. And if we continue to love the lifestyle we have here in Utah, we need to be wiser about how we use our water. And everyone can make a difference. So thank you.
Well, thank you for the update. I'm always realizing when it comes to water how much I don't know. So thank you again for making the time.
All right, Connor, thank you. And by the way, I learn something about water every day that I think I should have known. So it's an ongoing education process for all of us.
All right. That's Gene Shawcroft. He's the general manager for the Central Utah Water Conservancy District, also representing Utah on the Upper Colorado River Commission.
Since we recorded that interview with Mr. Shawcroft, the Upper Basin states, including Utah, have called for mediation. The Salt Lake Tribune reports some negotiators believe a seven-state agreement will be preferable to a federally imposed plan. According to Fox 13 News, the disagreements center over which part of the basin has to take cuts and how deep they are. The lower basin states have put a deal on the table that includes cutting their water use, and if there's a surplus in Lake Powell, passing that along to Lake Mead. Park City Council held a regular meeting last night. Joining me in the studio with a debrief is Council Member Diego Zagara. Park City Municipal is a KPCW financial supporter. Good morning, Diego.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Park City.
Okay, Diego, I can say that. I understand there was a discussion, at least a preliminary discussion, of the fiscal year 27 capital and operating budgets. Big picture, where are we in this process, and what stood out for you from last night's discussion?
Sure, yeah. This is, I believe, the third discussion we've had around our fiscal year 27 budget. We have at least a couple more scheduled before end of June, at a time when we'll approve the budget. I think the key takeaways are that it's a year of flat revenue, and the staff has done a wonderful job at keeping projects moving forward. Despite any complications winter may have provided, I think the city's still in a solid position, and I'm excited to keep moving along. I will use this as an opportunity to invite the public to join us. It's a bit of a running joke that it's an item on the agenda that doesn't get a lot of public feedback. I think we've had, on average, one annual public comment around this, and would love to get more.
So, Diego, as you go through this process, again, two more meetings, you mentioned that it was a flat revenue season. That's interesting to me. Given how mediocre, that's a charitable word for our ski season, It was flat. It didn't really go down much, the sales tax revenue?
I was impressed as well. Yeah. Sales were up, as I recall, and our TRT dollars at a different level were down. So it seems to be a wash. People were out not skiing necessarily, but instead shopping and going out, spending money on Main Street perhaps. So that's what we saw.
Okay, I want to focus on one or two items that were significant. One of them was the increase of council and mayor comp packages, and that looked like a pretty substantial increase. Do you have a sense of, I think it was like over 50%, do you have a sense of where that's coming from?
Sure, yeah, and just for the record, that's coming back to council in a couple of weeks. We'll be discussing that. My sense is twofold. One, that we've generally lagged behind other comparable jurisdictions in the area. I'll use our friends at Summit County as an example, that compensation's around $70,000, quite a bit more than city council compensation. And the other thing that's important to me is when that compensation is low and when folks have to, say, step away from full-time positions, it limits the pool of candidates that might have the opportunity to be in office. It limits it to, or I should say, it takes out the opportunity for members of our workforce to do it. I recognize I'm in a privileged position in my career where I can be a little more flexible and have this opportunity, and I'd love for us to increase the pool of candidates that can run for office, that can represent us, and have that representation come from different segments of our community.
So in terms of process, I assume this would have come from staff originally, and that's something that you guys will end up discussing?
Yeah, it's a joint conversation, and it has a lot to do with where we are from an inflation perspective, from a budget perspective, and in 2 weeks we'll have an open discussion.
And that'll be picked up at the council meeting in 2 weeks.
Yes.
Okay. There was a recommendation to remove, I don't know if you focused on this one, some contingency budget items like snow removal. Did you focus on that one at all?
We touched on it slightly, and I think it has to do with the fact that we've generally done a good job at that, and it's worked out this last year. As we know, it was underutilized.
Yeah, well, and hopefully that won't happen again. Anything else you want to touch on the budget other than reminding people that there's going to be a more detailed discussion in 2 weeks?
To underscore, we'd love to have folks come join us, weigh in, and I think the budget department has also done a better job at simplifying it and talking about it in a way that's more easy to understand for folks.
So last week, Tana was on and we were debriefing the meeting, and there was a lot of discussion about water. This week we talk about fire. I understand you guys had a report from the fire district. I think a lot of people are somewhat concerned that the dry conditions could lead to a dangerous fire season. What did you hear from the fire district last night?
Yes, El Nino year. It's going to be a long, hot summer. Given our conditions, we're encouraging folks to observe restrictions at all time and be good stewards of our land. Just let's do our best as a community to stay on top of it. I know we have one of the best crews here when it comes to fire. We got an interesting data point yesterday. We were asked, how many wildfires do you think have happened in our community over the last 10 years? And the number was 32, I believe. And they do a good job at suppressing them quickly, and they've remained relatively small. So I didn't realize the number was that big, and it has to do with the response our fire chief and their team has.
I'm sure the chief would appreciate this. If you remember off the top of your head, are there current fire restrictions in place, and what are they?
I have to phone a friend on that one.
Okay, well, that's okay. But, I mean, any chance we get a time to remind the community about those, it's probably a good thing. So, yes,
thanks,
we will follow up on that. Pride resolution. Pride Month was on the ballot. I understand the city plans to put Pride banners on Main Street. This is consistent with last year's decision, as I understand it, to fly banners after the Utah legislature banned flags. Matter at all controversial? Did it pass right through?
Not controversial.
Okay.
Very matter of fact, these are our community's values, and I'm grateful that we are doing that once again.
Okay. Diego, a group of citizens has been meeting at the Old Maverick. It seems like it's Tuesdays at the Maverick, where they have donuts. And this is a group that's trying to support an effort to have the 5-acre site emphasize open space over housing. I believe the park director said, were you there on Tuesday?
I was there on, was it Tuesday morning? Yes, Tuesday morning, yeah.
And you and Tana, how would you characterize, obviously you got the chance to hear their concern firsthand.
Yeah.
Tell me, how would you characterize, what are they saying?
Yeah, I think the general message there is that they're interested in seeing more open space. In addition to what we already have, this community has done such a great job at investing in these spaces. I can list them off, okay, quickly. Just open and green spaces around town, Library Field, City Park, Round Valley, Treasure Mountain, Bonanza Flat. I'm grateful that we've done that over the years. And what I'm hearing is a desire to connect, to create, for us to create spaces where people can come together. And to me, this art-centric mixed-use project will provide that opportunity.
You know, it's interesting, Diego. There's like fundamental economic truisms, which is, if you want to have more affordable housing, the space to build housing, and you want to have more open space, at some level, those two just sort of kind of run into each other, right? And this seems to me like the latest touch point where we're actually seeing it more directly, right? In the past, it's almost been a little abstract. I'm going to buy this many acres for open space. You don't ever have this sort of direct trade-off between open space and housing. And so this is really, to colloquially put the potato on the fork, right? So where, I hear what's happening. How will this process play out?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think what you're aiming at is that we're more successful when we're balancing needs of our community. And of course, there's a need for recreation and open space and a need for us to have neighbors and community and our workforce near the centers of employment. It's no surprise to anyone that our main arteries are clogged up in the mornings with traffic. And we heard from transit yesterday with some potential transit solutions that include a portion of the 5-acre parcel as currently imagined. And I'm excited to see that we're thinking of these different issues as connected and not independent. What I'm most excited about this project is the idea of the 2-acre public plaza, that when it's completed, I imagine I can be there with friends on a Friday afternoon listening to former Mayor Dana Williams play a show on the stage, have a beer at one of the restaurants that's there, go shopping at one of the stores that are on the first level. We want to see a vibrant space here, something that brings people together and something that we can be proud of. And I also want to make sure that we're continuing to listen to our community members.
Okay, so where does it go from here? As I understand it, this has not sort of changed the trajectory where it goes now to planning?
Now to planning, okay. Yes. And I would say that it's, again, an invitation for that group to continue to chat with us and share their thoughts as no final development agreement is in place yet. We're still many months away from that, so... Yeah, it's an ongoing conversation, and we want to make it the best possible project for our community.
Okay, Diego, for years I have asked city council people when they come to visit, okay, when am I going to see a shovel in the ground? And it's a moving target, and you just mentioned there's still time to go. Get out your crystal ball. When am I going to see a shovel in the ground?
Wow. I bet there's people at the city right now looking at...
the radio. Yeah, thinking of, don't answer that, Diego.
Yeah, it's a tough question, right? And perhaps I'll answer it in the safest way possible, and it's within my term.
Okay, that's a practical answer. Thank you.
And there is a timeline too, mm-hmm. But realistically and historically, we've seen those timelines not always adhere to the ideal scenario. Yeah. So. Yeah. It's hard to say.
Okay. Well, I do hope you guys keep the pressure on. It's time to get this one done.
Thank you. That's the feedback we've been receiving as well.
You touched briefly. I want to touch on transportation before we go. You got an overview of some transportation performance metrics yesterday.
Yeah.
Looks like buses are on time. Tell me a little bit about what you learned and what you took away from that.
So very cool new presentation. If folks haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. We are now looking at our transportation system, at our transit system in a more holistic way with real-time metrics. And this assessment, these performance metrics are going to help us make determinations on future improvements. I asked a question yesterday, what is the threshold for a conversation to happen around a service change? What is the right number of people per bus ride, per bus route that makes sense, and how to... A fellow council member asks, how do you bring new lines, new routes online? And these metrics are going to help the transit department and council make policy decisions that lead to better outcomes, which is more people riding transit.
And fewer people in cars alone. I understand that was another issue that came up. What kinds of things are being discussed in terms of methods to try to reach that fewer people in cars, the riding alone phenomenon?
Sure. I mean, I would say the most obvious one is Recreate 248. The Gordo capture lot that we're discussing should help in getting folks out of their cars onto buses that are more directly and more efficiently getting them to where they want to be. In the case of many driving into town, it's the base of the ski resorts. So that's one method, one lever that we can pull, make transit more efficient. I mean, we're already blessed in this town where transit is free. Often surprised at how many people visit our town and are surprised by that. And I keep forgetting that that's not often the case, that we are a privileged community and that we can do that. And so that's a lever that we ought to keep communicating and getting the word out there to our visitors.
Okay, Diego, I think sooner or later, you guys are going to have to figure out a way to do a capture lot somewhere, whether it's Gordo or Richardson Flat or whatever. Is that another thing you expect to be able to get done in your term?
Based on the timeline that we saw yesterday, I would hope so. Okay. I would hope that that's a project that we can get off and execute on in the next few years. I know that 224 is underway, and you know, thanks to everyone for their patience as this project happens. 248 is, I think, what we have our eyes set on next when it comes to transit solutions.
Diego, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
Yeah, I might as well invite the community to join folks at the McPolin Barn this afternoon for a historic preservation celebration. Yesterday we adopted a resolution proclaiming May as Historic Preservation Month in Park City. We celebrated the preservation of the Silver King Coalition Mine, which is a pretty cool structure. And it's the off season. Frequent your local establishments, be kind to each other, and enjoy the weekend.
Thank you, Diego. We'll be right back. Once again, Park City Municipal is a KPCW financial supporter, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you. So a massive and somewhat controversial new data center is being planned for Box Elder County. Hugo Ricard Bell has been following the story for KUER, while our own Grace Dorfler has been covering MIDA closely. Morning, Grace.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Hugo.
G'day, Grace. G'day, Roger. How are you?
Thanks for joining us.
Hey, anytime.
Okay, can you share, let me start with you, Hugo, can you share with the audience a bit, it's obviously been widely publicized, but let's set the groundwork a little bit. Can you share a bit about the scope of the project and what it's going to do once it's completed? I hear this word data center, and I sort of wonder what's going on in there.
Yeah, so this project has been getting rumbles for a couple of months now. I mean, if you go back into Governor Cox's weekly schedule, he met with Kevin O'Leary in early January. And Kevin O'Leary, he's that Shark Tank celebrity investor.
Mr. Wonderful.
Who is backing the project. So there has been rumblings. It has been around. But it's really come into big statewide attention in the last couple of weeks. I mean, Grace, correct me if I'm wrong. I went down on up to Box Elder County, on Monday for the county commission had to meet to agree whether or not they were going to work with MIDA on this massive project. It's going to produce something like 9 gigawatts worth of power, or use 9 gigawatts worth of power, and it's this giant data center that's going to require a fair bit of water as well. So that's where a lot of the controversy comes from, the water rights behind it, and it's going to take up around 40,000 acres split up against three different lots on that sort of near that northern point of the Great Salt Lake. So it's going to be the biggest data center in Utah once it's been built, but it's one of the biggest projects in Box Elder for quite some time.
I would think so. And I got up this morning, I was trying to visualize 40,000 acres or 60 square miles, and the one that resonated with me is it's the idea if you had a 1 mile wide road that ran from Layton to Provo, that would be 60 square miles. It's an astounding size. Grace, you know, once again, our friends at MIDA have made an appearance. Let's sort of set the stage a little bit about what MIDA is and why is it in this movie?
Yeah, so MIDA has been around for a little bit under two decades now, and in recent years, it's really grown and really become a much more noticeable presence in the state. Of course, our Wasatch Back listeners are familiar with the Military Recreation Facility, more commonly known as Deer Valley East Village and the Jordan L Basin area, the Sky Ridge Development, parts of Hideout. Those are all part of MIDA's presence here in Wasatch County. And so MIDA's projects are twofold. One, they're designed to support the military in some way. In our case, there's a military hotel. And the other piece of it is economic development. And as Hugo can speak to, economic development is a huge factor in this Box Elder County project.
Yeah, when MIDA originated, it seems, and maybe it's just me, but it seems to have moved an awful long way from the original concept of its mission.
Yes, yeah, so the initial talks about MIDA were around the Hill Air Force Base, that Air Force Base being able to stay open into the future, as well as replacing a small seven-room lodge at Snow Basin.
Which got us Easter Valley.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The Grand Hyatt Deer Valley, the 400-room hotel with 100 rooms from the military, was created to replace that seven-room lodge. And that was a years-long process.
Okay. So why does it matter, either one of you, why does it matter that MIDA is in this picture? How do they fit into the process of land use management and local jurisdictions? And how does it work? Go ahead, take a risk.
So MIDA... What's interesting about this project in particular, and I'll let Hugo follow up on this, is whereas in Wasatch County, plans came together kind of gradually in piecemeal. You know, there was this vision of the hotel, and then MIDA gradually added more land, more projects. In Box Elder, by contrast, MIDA has been working with the private landowners primarily, and then bringing it to the government later in the process. So... It's I guess, a little bit of a flipped timeline in that regard. You know, MIDA requires local government consent to do its work. And Hugo, I think I'll let you take over from there.
Yeah, actually, Grace, you hit the nail on the head there. That is what makes this project so interesting, because it seems like there's quite a bit of, I don't want to call it misinformation, but misunderstanding of what role Box Elder County actually plays in this. On Monday, when I went up to the protest and the commission decision, it was hundreds of protesters. And I've been to a lot of these sort of protests in my work here. I've never seen anything get quite this fiery. I mean, they were screaming. One woman behind me called out to the commissioners, "We know where you live," you know, that sort of thing. And that's what I think also sets this apart from other protests I've been to, is this is really small town local government. Like, these Box Elder County commissioners are neighbors to their voters. You know, their kids play in the same little league team, that sort of thing. And so it started just mounting and mounting and mounting with pressure. And it got to the point where the Box Elder County, I didn't hear their voices on the microphones once. Like, I couldn't understand a word they were saying. It was actually getting kind of difficult to even report on, because I had no idea if they'd voted yes or no yet, because of how loud it was in the room. Mm-hmm. So, and yeah, go on.
No, I was going to say, so the picture I'm getting is that somebody or bodies have been sort of planning this thing directly with the private developer before they bring. So people at Box Elder in the government space have clearly been trying to work on this for months, but I take it hasn't had a lot of public visibility until now.
Well, no, it hasn't had a government, like local government hasn't been involved until now. So that's the big thing about this project. And that's what a lot of people thought, that this vote on Monday was going to, if they voted yes, it meant the project was going ahead. If they voted no, they could stop it in its tracks and it wasn't going to get built. That's not the case at all. It's a really complicated thing in local code, and I'm going to mess it up if I go too deep, but basically a lot of the land is unzoned or private, which means MIDA is able to cut these deals with the state government and these private landowners before involving Box Elder County. And so I sat down with Commissioner Lee Perry yesterday and just sort of asked him about, you know, what did your vote actually do? And he said, the only thing my vote did, voting yes, brings me to the table on this project. If I voted no, they get to still build the project. If I vote yes, they get to build the project, but then we can negotiate stuff that we get out of it. So in other words, they're paying for all the construction. They're going to give us 10 fire trucks and EMS services and that sort of thing. So it was really interesting. A lot of people felt like this vote was going to be the be-all and end-all of whether this project goes ahead, but that's not really the case at all. And that's where this protest really sort of overflowed.
Yeah. And if I could add to that as well, once a MIDA project area is created, MIDA is then the land use authority. So it effectively acts as the planning commission and council for decisions going forward.
So is what we're saying, though, is if they had voted no, under the existing framework, MIDA could still have stepped in and said, okay, we're just going to do it anyway and become the land use authority and taken on all those obligations, all those powers itself. Hugo.
Yes. Yeah, that's essentially the message that we've been given, and that's what Commissioner Lee Perry was telling me. Like, he actually, you know, in a direct quote, he sort of said, looked at this project that was handed to me a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, maybe a month ago, and he just said, "Wow, they can just build this, and there is absolutely nothing I can do to stop it." So he and his commissioners say that they voted yes. And by voting yes, they were able to negotiate terms for Box Elder County as well.
I would add that this is also a bit of a pattern that we see in MIDA over the past few years as they have created more project areas, the Utah National Guard project area, the Tooele Army Depot project area. A lot of the work happens behind closed doors. Details are worked out in meetings that are not public, and then things are brought to the MIDA board for a vote, and that's the first time that the public typically learns about these projects.
Hmm. And I'm going to ask a question out of left field. Given the intensity of the protests and the anger, does this shape into a political issue for the Box Elder County commissioners? And do you happen to know if any of them are up for election this year?
Yeah, I think they are. And whether it becomes a political issue, I think once more and more information from their end comes out, I think people are going to gradually realize that this really wasn't a county problem. This was the state government and MIDA and that sort of thing. And Box Elder County kind of became the fall guy in this a little bit for the public. And, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric around, like, oh, there was no public comment and the stuff like that. There was hours of public comment in Box Elder County, town hall meetings and that sort of stuff. But they said, they just had their hands tied in this issue.
And does the MIDA, are you guys continuing to report on sort of the political elements of MIDA itself? You've got the MIDA chairman, I believe, is that Stuart Adams, the chairman of from the Senate?
That's right, yes. Senator Jerry Stevenson is another familiar name on the MIDA board.
And has there been reporting on whether or not we're seeing political contributions to PACs related to the people who are trying to get business in front of MIDA? Hugo?
Thank you for giving me my next thing I'm going to look into, Roger.
Oh, that's just a question. Anytime you're seeing this kind of economic activity by political figures, it's always a reasonable question to ask.
You have to wonder.
Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit more about the project. We talked about how big it is, which just blows me away. How do they plan to meet the power and, more importantly, the water needs?
So at the moment, they're applying for, or they are looking at things like water rights. So something that happened this week is there was a water rights application done by a local rancher that he was trying to get it changed from agricultural use to industrial use. And then he actually retracted that this week, and there was a big sort of what's going on there. But essentially they've come out and said, no, we're resubmitting it in a couple of months once we have more evidence to make sure that we get it across the board. So it's going to take quite a lot of water. The exact numbers are failing me at the moment, but my understanding is about 3,000 acre feet and a reserved 10,000 acre feet. I want to make sure I double check that. We do have a number of stories on this on the KUER website if people want to find out more about it. But that's my understanding of water. As far as power goes, Grace, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe they're building their own power plant as well to sort of source from?
That's right. MIDA has promised that this project will create and use all of its own power. It's also right by a natural gas pipeline, I believe.
Okay. Where does the process go from here? Is this the kind of thing that might be subject to a viable, as opposed to just, but a viable legal challenge?
So I actually, so there is an application in at the moment for a referendum in Box Elder County to overturn the commissioner's decision. And I asked Commissioner Lee Perry about this yesterday. Well, what are the ramifications of that if they overturn your decision? And he said very plainly, the ramifications are everything that we cut in a deal with MIDA to get out of it for Box Elder County goes away, and the project goes forward anyway. So it's actually, in his mind, a detriment if this referendum passes. But that's the only legal challenge that we know of at the moment. There are environmental groups that I know of who are looking into very seriously to whatever legal options they have, but it's too early to tell from my point of view as to where those will land.
Right, this is a story we are going to continue to follow. Hugo Rickard-Bell and Grace Dorfler, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up after the NPR News, we've got the Community Campfire. Amber's going to feature a special Mother's Day story about the Midway Bakery, a sister-owned community staple. They run the bakery in honor of their mother. And Coach Bill Skinner is going to be back from his road trip and on the mic. He's going to share his wit and wisdom on all things sports. And somehow I might expect that we might hear a little bit about his perspective on the NBA playoffs.